a long time ago, I was thinking about this. I'll talk about the need for free settings in bell type experiments. I'll go through the proposal for an experiment to use humans in this way. I'll talk about the feasibility of such an experiment. It looks like it might just be feasible. I'll talk a bit about a paper I wrote a few years ago called Bell Inequalities with Retarded Settings. And I'll also talk about the in the case that this experiment sort of panned out in the way that Ravi just mentioned, I'll talk about how you might go about interpreting such a result. So a long time ago, when I was an undergraduate, I had the idea that we might want to use humans to switch the settings in a Bell experiment. Back then, I was motivated by it being to test a certain idea of mind-matter duality. Back in 1989, I wrote two preprints on the subject. I submitted them, and neither of them, of course, was accepted for publication. Here's the first one. You have to imagine receiving this nowadays. You would know that it was from a crazy person. So I wrote this on a typewriter, but the idea was the same one I'm going to talk about today. I started my PhD, and I worked with Ewan Squires, who had an interest in this kind of thing. That's why I chose to work with him. I made another attempt at writing a paper, this time a little bit less crazy, though still maybe crazy enough, too crazy to be published. For this one, I learned how to use tech. This was before the days of LaTeX. Back then, people wrote papers in tech. My first mention in the published record that I'm aware of is in Ewan Squires' book. He wrote this book. It's a nice little book called Conscious Mind in the Physical World. It's sort of a physicist's take on the subject of consciousness. He mentioned that he had this student working on this idea back then. John Bell, in his what I think was the last paper he wrote, certainly the last paper he wrote on quantum foundations, mentioned the idea too. He talked about using experimental physicists or some other random devices to choose the settings. So it seems like he wasn't especially concerned that they'd be experimental physicists or humans, but he didn't discuss the issue of mind in this context. But this is the reference that people usually give to this idea of using humans. So here's a kind of the figure from the original crazy paper I wrote. And you can see the idea is, as I explained, you want to take signals from humans to choose the settings. Now, if you ask humans to press buttons, it would be too slow. So I proposed using EEG signals directly. This would be a lot quicker, as I'll explain. In a moment. Okay. So back in 1989, I believed that an experiment like this was actually very likely to lead to a violation of quantum theory. In the meantime, a number of years has passed. I won't say how many. Oh, you can work it out, I suppose. I believe that less than I did then. Now I think it's pretty unlikely that it would lead to a violation of quantum theory. But I still think it's worth doing. At the time, I gave up on convincing people that this was an experiment worth doing. Partly, it seemed like it was a very difficult experiment to do. That was true back then. The idea didn't seem to get any traction. So instead, I built a more conventional career in that very conservative field of quantum foundations. Then a few years ago, I revived the idea for this. There was a book that was sort of based on a conference. I forget what it was called, a proceedings for a conference, like Speakables and Unspeakables, something like that. A few years ago, I think the book was published this year. So I put this paper on the archive, and I gave it a very boring title, hoping nobody would notice that it had this kind of crazy idea in it. I was walking along the corridor just up there, and I bumped into Mike Lazaridis, and he said, "I liked your paper." And I said, which one? And this was the one. And he said, "We should do the experiment. Send me a proposal." So I started thinking about that. So I started thinking about how to actually do the experiment. And so this is sort of in some ways an answer to Mike's request. So since 1989, three things have changed. First of all, I think attitudes have changed. There have been several mentions of the idea of using humans in some of the recent experiments that were performed, I think starting with the 1998 paper by Zeilinger and others. They mentioned the possibility of using humans. And other papers, the most recent paper by Henson et al. Doing the Bell test mentioned using humans. There was this big Bell test internet phenomenon. I think it was more of a public outreach, public relations phenomenon, but they tried to collect information over the internet that was inputted by people. I mean, that experiment wouldn't really satisfy the kind of conditions that you need to do this kind of thing properly, but at least it suggests that attitudes are changing and that one, it might be worth trying to do this kind of experiment. Second thing that's changed is that the experiment is, I would say, just about feasible. That wasn't true in 89. And of course, back in 89, I didn't have tenure. Even though it's unlikely that this would, an experiment like this would violate quantum theory, I think it's a worthwhile goal. An experiment like this would act as a kind of stretch goal, push the development of new technologies. You know, such things like there's a field, brain computer interface, and that would be a way of connecting that field with quantum information. So by now, like I said, I think it's much less likely that quantum theory would be violated. I mean, I think it's less likely than I did back then. But nevertheless, the probability times the payoff is still very big. If the experiment was performed and the result came out positive, as in quantum theory was violated in accord with Bell's inequalities, then that would be a really significant result for many reasons. And so I think it's worth trying to do this experiment. So first of all, let me talk about the need for free settings in Bell type experiments. So if the settings, this represents the two stations in a Bell experiment, and you can imagine that each side you have some setting that's chosen. Now if the settings are just static, so they don't change, then it's possible to communicate, to send a signal from one side to the other, which tells you what the setting is. And in that case, you don't impose the locality conditions that are needed for the derivation of Bell's inequalities. So the original experiments that were done back in the 70s just had static analyzer settings. And that was subsequently improved in experiments by Aspect et al. And then Zeilinger and so on. So if you don't do that, if you try to change the settings, then you can imagine different ways of changing them. If the settings are decided by some kind of deterministic process, then it's still possible for a light speed signal to communicate the earlier state to the other side. So the deterministic state over here, so the state over here from which the later setting is deterministically given, could be communicated to side B. And in that way, once again, you wouldn't succeed in imposing the locality conditions. If, however, there's some way to decide these settings freely by some kind of intervention, then there's no way for a light speed signal to communicate the settings to the other end. So that's what's shown in this diagram. Here we have some kind of intervention which along this path here decides the setting. This is meant to be a light cone. So if this intervention switches the setting just here, then you can see that the setting will be changed by the time measurement A happens, and yet there isn't time for this value, this intervention, news of this intervention to reach side B. Any questions at this stage?
It's a question, but there's probably some ambiguity in the notion of intervention.
Yeah,
it would have to be something that was totally outside the universe, and there's nothing. There is nothing like that.
Well, that's perceived, so
sorry.
Yeah.
Do you mean that the intervention is not, like, essentially a space-time singularity? Like it's
no, I'm not saying that. No, I'm just saying something. We'll talk on, I think, on the next slide as to what possible candidates for interventions are. So these are the three things that have been proposed. So one idea of an intervention is that you have a random number generator, okay? And then, you know, the idea is that somehow this would, since it's random, it couldn't be anticipated by the other side. The problem with that, of course, is that the random number generator could be governed by some underlying deterministic laws, in which case it wouldn't really succeed in setting up the conditions for the locality conditions. And the kind of experiments that have been done, well, many experiments of this sort have been done. The recent experiments that succeeded in closing all the loopholes were of this nature, where they used random number generators. In fact, the random number generators they used were quantum random sources, so there's questions there as well. Another sort of intervention you could imagine is a signal from a distant galaxy. So the idea being, if you go far enough back, perhaps you have regions that are not in causal contact, and so there wouldn't be time for a signal to reach the other side. And recently, an experiment has been done of this sort, not using distant galaxies, but using stellar sources in our own galaxy. But nevertheless, it's a step, as they say, it's a step in that direction. And then the last thing that's been proposed is using humans. So as Raphael said, this is kind of a crazy idea because it's crazy to suggest that this will be outside of physics. But still, this is something we can investigate, and I'll talk about the interpretations later. So here's the kind of proposed experiment. I'll just go through this. So one of the things here is you need to do a very long experiment. So experiments have been done which are on about this scale, over roughly 100 kilometers. But in order to do that, you need to have some way of communicating entangled particles over a great distance. They did it at altitude, so between in the Canary Islands, between two mountaintops. There was a source here, and I'll talk about that experiment later, actually. So the problem with that is, of course, the two stations are not necessarily in a place where you want to have a lot of people. So the idea is you could have an experiment like this. You have a Bell experiment like this. Now you want to communicate settings from humans on each side. And so the idea is to have humans. You see, I've drawn them wearing EEG headsets. These things are actually commercially available nowadays. And you want them to transmit you want to transmit that to some retransmitting station, which then receives it and it's used to give an input. The reason for having lots of people is that the rate from just one person isn't going to be high enough to get any sort of significant result. So the idea is that you have something like 100 people at each end, and you can imagine them being located in two towns that are on either side of the Bell experiment. And since this signal is transmitted at light speed, you won't lose anything from not having them right next to the switching station to enter the Bell experiment. I think it's feasible to imagine getting 100 people at each end for approximately 2 hours. I think it's not feasible to have 1,000 people at each end for 4 months, just to give some random numbers. You know, so what you could feasibly do in this kind of experiment is limited, just because of the people management size of it. Okay. So this experiment has various components. First of all, you need a long Bell experiment. The longer it is, the better, as long as the coincidence rate doesn't go down too much. I'm thinking roughly 100 kilometers. Then you need human input, so you need a large number of people. And I'll explain why to use these headsets in a moment. You need fast electronics. You want to keep the delays in getting the signal from here to the switch as small as possible. You need some kind of neurological analysis. You know, when we press a button or we do something like that, that corresponds to certain patterns in these signals, and we want to pick out the right ones so that we know what we're filtering for. And then, like I mentioned, there are some people management issues. So first of all, we need a Bell experiment. An experiment where, under normal operating conditions, Bell's inequality is violated by a significant amount. So here's an example like this. We have, I'm drawing it in a sort of asymmetric setup because that might be important. So we have a measurement over here and then a corresponding measurement result over here. And I'm defining this tau A sep as the time interval from this point here, which is the last chance to send a signal, a light speed signal to NB, and this point here when the measurement is made. Okay. I think it's clear from the geometry here. So that's tau A sep for separation. Tau B sep is the corresponding thing on the other side. And then if the situation is symmetric, then this is just the time it takes for a light to travel from one side of the experiment to the other. I define T experiment as the time taken to obtain a violation of the Bell inequalities to some given significance, you know, some given number of standard deviations of violation. Okay, so we need human inputs. I figured if I Googled Trump and red button, something would come up. And actually, quite a lot of things came up. Here's the best one. So you could imagine using humans to push the buttons to decide the setting at each end. The problem with that is that you can predict from EEG signals 1/10 of a second earlier with high probability, like in about 80%, what the choice will be. So in that time, a signal, a light speed signal, could carry information about the setting several times the radius of the other way. So it would be impossible to perform a terrestrial Bell experiment in this kind of scenario. So instead, I propose to use these EEG signals. According to, of course, I'm not an expert on this technology, but from the literature, it seems that the claim is that these signals travel through the light at electrical speeds near light speed, so that the same signal, you know, from a given neurological event, the same signal will be seen on different parts of the skull at the same time, as far as they can see. So it seems that no delay is really incurred in this way. So you don't have to worry about doing an experiment on this scale. We need to filter for the kind of features that are associated with free choices. You know, typically in a Bell experiment, you want to talk about making a free choice. That's, again, something I'm not an expert on. However, there has been a lot of research on this, especially in the context of this brain-computer interface technology that's been developed. People trying to see how you can input information into a computer directly without having to use a keyboard or something like that. One question is, what is the rate at which a human can produce these kinds of free choices? So I'm just for the sake of having a number, I've chosen the number 10 hertz, which is consistent with the sort of signal you get for beta waves. Beta waves are associated with people engaged in mental activity. But of course, we don't really know. I don't really know what that number should be, really.
When you say, I was imagining that you're going to have a human sort of generate randomness.
Right.
But it sounds like the 10 hertz is actually the frequency of a particular unconscious process in the brain. Is that what you just said, the beta wave?
Yeah, it's the awake and rest.
Sorry? Well,
it's the alpha.
It's the beta waves. Beta waves is 14 to 30 hertz. I'm just imagining, imagine if you filter on these signals for something corresponding to something you imagine is a free choice. Then the question is, what is the frequency of that? Of course, I don't know. So I'm just giving a number, which is 10 hertz. And that's just based on this, but it could, this number could be way off.
But what's the evidence that the oscillations of beta waves correspond to free choices?
Well, again, I don't know. I mean, this is something that would need to be investigated further. I'm just trying to give a ballpark figure here. I mean, the only evidence is that when you're relaxed, well, if you're asleep, you're in deep sleep, maybe there's no free choices going on. And maybe by the time you get here, then you're making a lot of free choices. So this would give you an order of magnitude. But it's, yeah.
Does it mean we could actually make 10 free choices in a second?
Could you, I don't know, could you sort of imagine? Yeah, it's pretty fast, isn't it? But how fast do you think, Raphael? It doesn't have to be pressing a button. It could just be being engaged in some thought process that requires making three choices. Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay. So it's good we're starting the experimental activity right here. Sorry, lots of questions suddenly. I think you were first in this.
So you're referring to these like action potential experiments, right? Where it's just to get what I'm assuming that's what the motivation is, where they have people decide to press a button and they find like a spike in the waveform, and then they can predict whether or not they decide to press the button or not from that.
Yeah, the particular experiment I read about was where there were people typing on a keyboard, and they were trying to predict what they were typing just by looking at the at the waves, and they could predict with about 80% accuracy.
And they found like a periodic or quasi-periodic signal? I would have thought it would just be like a single pulse, and then you said, I guess the details
don't matter. Yeah. I mean, if any experiment like this was to be done, you'd have to employ somebody who actually understood this particular science to make some progress. Yeah. But this number 10 is kind of important, because you'll see later it's the square of that that enters into the, you know, into the rate that you see. You want to be getting it as high as possible. To get 100 people thinking at this rate for 2 hours may be asking too much. I don't know.
So what's the advantage of using humans instead of the random number generator?
Well, that's the question that's been investigated. Maybe if you use humans, then it would make a difference. So this is a kind of a radical proposal
We don't know in advance what the advantage would be as opposed to just using the random number generator.
So the idea is to investigate. Well, if it turned out it made a difference, whether you used humans or just random number generators, then that would be significant, clearly. And we can talk about that later. You know, whether this is motivated and how significant it would be. Right. So you can imagine if you have NA humans and A, then the rate of human-induced switching would be roughly NA times this rate for each human. So that's the reason you want a lot of humans. Okay. So let's define this tau A N is the time interval. Maybe just show it in this diagram. So imagine a signal has just failed to reach side B, and the switch has happened. Then you have a certain amount of time for the measurement at side A to happen and the locality condition to still be imposed. And there should be an N on here. That's tau A, tau A N. And then the average over all the people you have engaged in the experiment is tau A. So that's the amount of time you have when you have a switch to get the coincidence happening. If you look at this diagram, there's a certain amount of dead time there, and that's because of delays in getting this signal from here to the switching. And you want to keep these delays as small as possible. So there's four sources of delay. One is getting it from the brain interior to the EEG headset. That seems to be pretty small. There's electrical delays in the equipment, It seems, according to previous papers I've read on this, where they've done the same thing without using humans, that these delays can be made very small as well. That's the claim in some of these previous papers. There's delays due to the fact if you're sending radio wave frequencies to communicate the signal to the device, that these will be slowed down just because the refractive index of air for radio waves is bigger than one. That should be a small effect as long as the distance isn't too great. And then there's geometric effects. You know, if your people are not exactly behind the apparatus but are off to the side, then there'll be a delay due to that. Okay, and then people management. This will be the fun part of the experiment. And quite challenging, I think. You'd have to manage a large number of people. You could imagine arranging two simultaneous outreach events consisting of about 100 people each. You'd have to fit the headsets, which depending on the type of headset you use can take a long time or be very quick. And you'd have to engage them in some appropriate activity. So when I searched on the internet for images of crowds of people wearing headsets, these two came up. These people were engaged in an experiment where they listened to music and their EEG waves were monitored. And these people were engaged in a marketing campaign experiment, perhaps more sinister. So the fraction, so we define alpha to be the fraction of time during the running of the experiment that there's a human-induced switch at each end, because you need to impose these locality conditions from both directions. Yes?
Just a clarification. Is the idea that they're choosing a detector setting or that they're just making some choices?
They're just doing stuff which we imagine will consist of free choices or interventions or whatever it is we want. They don't have to be aware of what setting they're choosing, as long as they're engaged in appropriate activity. So you don't—they don't have to, rotate the switch to one direction or the other.
But it's essential that there are choices involved, not just thinking about things.
Well, thinking about things might involve choices. Depends what you do. When you solve a problem, are you making choices? I think you are. Probably. So, this is a question that would have to be answered, but I think thinking would be a pretty good kind of activity to engage people in.
Okay. It's a predictable choice. Is it really a choice?
Yeah. It may be that we only make one or two unpredictable choices in our entire lifetime, in which case we're screwed. Okay. Yeah, so the rate at which you see the condition fulfilled at both sides is just given by this. That's fairly obvious. And then you can see in terms of these other parameters, the number of humans and the rate of human switching and so on, it's like this. So you can see you really care about, all these parameters are important. The rate at which an individual person can switch goes in as the square, the distance of which the experiment is performed again comes in as the square. If it's a symmetric experiment, this is just the distance squared or the time interval squared. And again, the number of people at each side, it comes in as well. So this is the proportion of cases. Alpha is the proportion of cases where we might expect to see a violation of quantum theory and Bell's inequalities being satisfied, if this makes a difference. Okay. So there's two modes of operation for this kind of experiment. One would be to look at all the data that you collect and see if you get a shift in a violation of Bell's inequalities proportional to minus alpha. So from 2 root 2 in the direction of 2. The trouble with that is if alpha is small, then you might just lose this in the noise. Another mode of operation is where you filter for those cases where you believe there is a human-induced switch, and then look and see. So this filtering could be done afterwards. If you collect the data, you could analyze the data subsequently and look for such events. I think I've said all this already. There's this active field of B BCI, biological computer interface, not brain. We could try different templates for filters to identify things that would correspond as interventions in these EEG signals. We want to engage humans in some appropriate activity that for about, I think, 2 hours is probably the maximum you could imagine. You could also imagine doing controls. So if we did, this is very unlikely, but if we did happen to see some effect where quantum theory was violated, Bell's inequality is satisfied, then we'd want to be sure it wasn't some instrumental effect. You know, you could imagine that if you filter on some particular odd signal, that maybe the when that thing is satisfied, it just screws up the apparatus, and that's what you're seeing. You're not really seeing an effect. So there's two ways you could do this. You could insert a delay between the humans and the switching device. So the delay would enable a signal as to what the intervention was to get to the other side. Or you could simply record the EEG signal and then replay it. Under that scenario, the effect ought to go away in this crazy world where you actually see an effect. Okay, so let's look at the feasibility of this kind of experiment. So there's been a lot of long Bell experiments. Let's just look at these three. So in 1998 in Innsbruck, an experiment was done over 400 meters, not very far, but the important thing about this experiment was that they actually used random number generators for the first time to do the switching. And so they imposed the sort of locality conditions with those with those random number generators. It took about 10 seconds to see a violation of Bell's inequalities by 30 significant figures. By 30 standard deviations. So 10 seconds for a 30 standard deviation violation of Bell's inequalities, that's pretty good. If you calculate for this experiment the value of alpha, if you were to replace the random switching devices that they use, the random number generators, by humans, and you just assume that these delays that I mentioned are very small, and you assume 10 hertz. If you calculate alpha, you get 10 to the minus 6. So now you would require 4 months to do the experiment to get 30 standard deviation. You could accept a lower significance, but still it would take too long. You couldn't expect to have people wearing those headsets for 4 months. In 1997, there was an experiment done in Geneva over 10.9 kilometers. In this experiment, they didn't have random switching, but that's fairly trivial to add on. But it was a long experiment. It took, and this is just my best guess looking at the graphs that they have. It looks like it took about 1 hour to get a violation of Bell's inequalities, which had a significance of 10 standard deviations. Now, if you take that distance, you get 10 to the minus 3 for alpha, which means the experiment would take 1,000 hours to get similar significance. And that, I think, is too long. If you look at this beautiful experiment that was done in the Canary Islands, and I'll talk about that experiment again on the next few slides, the separation between the two ends of that experiment, in the frame of reference where the measurements were simultaneous, was 50 kilometers. It took them 10 minutes to get 16 standard deviations, a violation of Bell inequalities. For this experiment, the value of alpha is 10 to the minus 2. Suddenly, we're in the range of the feasible. But if we want to get the same significance, then it would take about 16 hours, which is just a bit too long to be asking people to wear the headsets.
Why do you say it's too long? Couldn't you have rotating groups of people?
You could, yeah. I mean, I just think
it's a popular idea.
Sure, sure. Columns, maybe you. Right, okay, right. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Yeah. I mean, I actually make money this way. I just thought I should set some parameters. I thought 200 people for 2 hours was a good thing to aim for. But maybe you're right. Maybe it would be massively oversubscribed. Yeah, but also it's expensive. Well, I suppose you could have revolving, yeah, like you say. Maybe the headgear is expensive to.
The same headgear.
Yeah, so you just keep swapping it from, you know, on a sort of conveyor. Right, yeah, maybe. yeah, so this is the Canary Islands experiment. Thomas Jennewein is now here, or at least at IQC, doing interesting experiments. Over distance. I think the most recent paper I saw was where he transmitted from a base station to a moving. From a base station to a moving aeroplane, sort of doing cryptography over some number of kilometers. Quantum cryptography. Okay, so this is the experiment. So they had two stations, one in La Palma and one in Tenerife. Let's see if I can see how this works. They create, I'm not sure where the, okay. Well, I can't see where, let me just describe in words because I can't see where the, oh, here it is. Here's the entangled photon source. So they create two photons. One photon stays over here. It goes through 6 kilometers of optical fiber before it goes into a bell, into a measurement station over here. The other photon is transmitted through free space over 144 kilometers to a telescope here in Tenerife. And this is done at altitude, so that you get presumably get a much better signal at altitude. And then over here, you do the experiment. At each end, they had a quantum random, a random number generator. It's just a quantum system. I think it was a photon impinging on a beam splitter used to switch the setting of this experiment, and likewise on this end. They also had a feature where they transmitted the actual quantum random number generator on the ALICE side was transmitted by a radio frequency link from this ground station up to ALICE. So the experiment was asymmetric. The photon at Alice's side was detected much earlier than the photon at Bob's side. So the parameters are 6 kilometers and 144 kilometers. But anyway, if you do the calculation, you get this. And what's interesting is if you don't impose that you have such a significant result, if you go just down to 6 standard deviations, then you can hit this magical 2 hour number that I was looking for. So it seems that this kind of experiment is feasible. You could also imagine trying to make the experiment symmetric, perhaps by having telescopes on both sides of the experiment, but that would presumably be more difficult because you'd reduce the rate. Okay. Could you make other improvements? Well, you could have more people, better headsets, faster electronics, greater distance. More efficient detectors. In recent years, the detectors have gotten much better. Two of the bad experiments that were done recently were photonic, and they had much more efficient detectors that made that possible, and it may be that that would make a big difference here. The efficiency of the detector factors in as eta squared, so it makes a big difference having efficient detectors. Okay, so that's the proposal. Here's the in that paper I published a few years ago, I talked about Bell's inequalities with retarded settings. So let me just explain that idea. So imagine you have this kind of theory where what happens over here depends on some state over here. So you could think about there being a retarded setting. So this is the setting that we're going to have over here, unless there's an intervention that switches it. Okay. So even if this apparatus is changing in some deterministic fashion, you can still have a retarded setting as to what the value is going to be, and that value can influence the physics over here locally. So in which case, the outcome result, the result of this experiment, this measurement, B, could depend on the setting at the side B and also the retarded setting from the other side. But now that could be different if you have some intervention. It could now take a different value, which is just A. So we have A sub R as the retarded setting and A. So we have this for side B, and then on the other side we have this. And we can use that to derive a bell-type inequality. So we use this standard way of deriving the Klausehorn, Shimini, Holt inequalities. Take this mathematical result. We insert these choices. But now we have retarded settings. We substitute integrate over the hidden variable. And now we get these Bell inequalities. Notice the difference here is that we have dependence on the retarded values also. These inequalities can't be violated. These inequalities wouldn't be violated by quantum theory if the actual settings and retarded settings are equal. You can see that because then the whole thing just collapses down, because if this has to equal this and that has to equal that, then AR prime is equal to AR. And you just get one term, so the whole thing collapses down. But if the retarded settings and actual settings are different, then quantum theory would violate these inequalities. And so you could imagine doing an experiment.
So can you clarify what the definition of each of the terms in the final inequality is? What is E of W?
Okay, so this, let me just say like one term here.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the expectation value. The normal expectation value you see, you measure in Bell's inequalities, the correlation function, where you have an actual setting A. Let me look at this one here. An actual setting A on Alice's side, an actual setting B on Bob's side, and then retarded settings AR on Alice's side as seen by Bob, and BR on Bob's side as seen by Alice.
Okay.
And these retarded settings are in principle things you could imagine knowing. So it's something you could imagine.
So should I think of AR as being part of the specification of B, some sort of things that are important for Bob's outcomes are the local setting B and the remote retarded setting?
Yeah, so over here, I mean, let's imagine for the sake of argument that this setting is only changed by interventions. Okay, then it has the polarizer or whatever it is a certain value A sub R until it gets changed to A by the intervention, and that can be communicated to the Bob side.
So from your notation, I presume that you don't allow the A outcome to depend on A retarded.
You could do I don't in this derivation. You could investigate where it does. I don't think. Let me see. So I think what I'm saying here would still have to be true, because that's adding an extra. Any model. So you could investigate that, and I think it would complicate this derivation.
Yeah, it's not clear to me that you get something non-trivial, because I think I can understand this as arising as follows. Just if I ask what constitutes the setting variables that are relevant for Bob's outcome, the answer is his local setting B and the retarded setting on the Alice's side. It's sort of it's kind of irrelevant to the mathematics that it happens to be on Alice's side and retarded. The analysis will go through the way it did before.
Yeah.
So I should be, am I right to think that you expect us to be persuaded by this, that this inequality holds? Like there's no, this just sort of follows the standard Bell logic.
Oh, in that case, if you want to say it like that, yeah, sure. It's not, over here. Yeah, you could think of, you could group these two things together.
Right.
And so on. What's so interesting, though, is
Bell logic on those groupings.
But yeah, that's right. That's not, But of course, what's interesting here, though, is if you impose that A equals AR and B equals BR, then this just collapses down to 2 times E of AB, and then that's just not, that's
the thing you're saying. So the point of this is it brings out how you need to have these retarded settings different to see a violation.
Yeah. But the mathematics is the same, like you say.
As long as A doesn't depend on AR.
Yeah, and I haven't really thought about that case. I'm sure.
I think it'll change if you do that. Then it's
right.
Like allowing common causes for the settings on the two sides.
Right.
That tends to
make
it impossible to violate the bell.
I have to investigate. OK, so you can build a model that has these kinds of properties. So here's a simple model. You just you have a hidden variable that goes over some range, flat distribution, just an angular hidden variable with flat distribution, and you make your result. You choose your result functions in some way, and you can get this result. Okay, this is a certain choice. Here's the important thing: is now this correlation function looks like this. So you can see you get a dependence on the retarded settings. And if this retarded setting is different from the actual setting on each side, then this correlation function will have to satisfy. Well, this correlation function always satisfies the inequalities I just gave you. And it's interesting in the case where the retarded and actual settings are different. When the actual and retarded settings are equal, then this just collapses down to the standard quantum correlation in agreement with quantum theory. But this doesn't violate the retarded Bell inequalities. OK. So now let's get to thinking about what it would mean if quantum theory were violated in this context. So suddenly, the consequences for quantum foundations will be very significant. You'd be seeing locality, after all, which would be striking. You'd also have to admit some kind of superdeterminism, because we know that when you randomly switch these settings, you don't see a violation of quantum theory. You still get a violation of Bell's inequalities. So to explain that in this kind of local context, you'd have to have some kind of superdeterminism where the retarded values could anticipate the later setting in the deterministic context. I have to admit, this superdeterminism is the thing I find most unappealing about this sort of scenario. So like I said, the consequences for quantum foundations would be significant. But the real importance would be for the sort of study of these kinds of questions concerning mind. If you got a violation of quantum theory when you used people to do the switching, and you didn't see it when you used random number generators or computers and so on, then that would be tremendously significant. Of course, it's also very unlikely that we'll see this, but it will be significant. So how would we account for this kind of result? And so I can think of 2 possibilities. Maybe there are more. So local superdeterministic dualistic theories. I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. This is where you have some kind of mind-matter duality. And then local superdeterministic theories in which, nevertheless, brains are somehow, because they're sufficiently complicated, able to give rise to free settings. Okay, so this idea of mind-matter duality was proposed by this guy, Descartes. And here's a figure he had from his treatise on the subject. Here's the idea that somehow there is a sort of mind and it's intervening on the brain and causing you to do things in one way or the other. And the idea is that these mind acts could provide the sort of interventions that we were talking about before, the things that would make these settings free. So it's not about randomness as such, but about this kind of intervention picture, this sort of dualist picture. There's a history in quantum foundations of thinking about this sort of dualism. So Wigner proposed the idea at one point that when you look at a quantum system, it collapses, There's the many minds interpretation, which is a sort of a tag on to the many worlds interpretation, where you have sort of, you know, you have this sort of dualist picture where there are many minds that somehow give meat to the many worlds interpretation. And then it's sometimes said that the Copenhagen interpretation is dualist. Nicholas Jizan wrote a paper recently where he claimed that the Copenhagen interpretation is a dualist picture. So there's a lot of history of people talking about duality, this kind of duality in quantum foundations, but it's usually in the context of solving the measurement problem. This is a different sort of context. This is not about solving the measurement problem, but instead about providing free settings. And indeed, we're also talking about violating quantum theory in some of these issues. Yeah, Marcus.
So maybe you come to that, but you have these other situations where you somehow use quantum information technology to transmit something like human-generated messages, maybe cryptography and so on. So as soon as you have some mechanism that breaks the standard quantum rules when humans intervene, would you expect that these kind of schemes break down as well?
Definitely the device-independent quantum cryptography would fail, because that relies on actually having a violation of Bell's hypothesis.
I mean, of course, I'm not expecting this result to see this result, really. I mean, I put a relatively low probability on it. And in the meantime, developing this kind of technology to provide this sort of brain-computer interfaces would actually be maybe a way of implementing and really imposing the locality conditions for device-independent cryptography. So there could be a kind of practical payoff here. It would be very difficult for an eavesdropper to intervene because it's too late. The signal is already. So this is the sort of the dualist picture. You could try to imagine a different sort of explanation of this result where it's seen. So it could be that physical systems are super deterministic, except for systems that are complex in the kind of way that's found inside brains. Now I can't quite work out how you could do this. It seems that there's a problem, in particular because we want these to be local theories, and locality suggests that we have microphysical laws. So you want to be able to account for the behavior of the brain locally in terms of different parts of the brain. It's difficult to see how this kind of theory could have this rather wacky property. But that's not to say it can't be done. I just can't quite imagine how you would build such a theory. I think in the case that a result like this was seen, you'd want to do further experiments and see what seemed more reasonable. So you can play around with this idea. You could imagine a variation on the Turing test. So here's the usual Turing test. You have a human interrogator. And he's talking to a human or an AI system via some computer interface, asking questions, getting answers, and he has to decide whether it's an AI system or a human. So that's the usual Turing test. Here's a variation. Now you have a Bell experiment, and you have you could do it in different ways. You could have an AI system at each end, or some physical system that was meant to pass the test at each end. Or you could have a human at one side and an AI system at the other side. And then, in order to pass this test, you'd have to cause the Bell inequality to be satisfied for an experiment where they're normally violated. What's nice about this test is it's objective. It doesn't depend on the human judgment of this guy. It's just simply an objective test, were it true that quantum theory was violated when you had humans. Okay.
Lucy.
Yeah.
Turing talks about basically this at the end of his paper.
But a Bell experiment?
Not a Bell experiment, but he's talking about ESP.
Do
you remember? Read that.
I mean, I've noticed he talked about that. I haven't read it, so I should
mention it. It's basically the same issue. There's something something about the mind that allows us to distinguish it from purely mechanical action. Because at the time, ESP was a kind of a live object being explored by government agencies.
Right.
So it's in there.
As you can now read, I think.
Okay, I should.
Okay. So, to conclude, this experiment is difficult, I would say, but just about feasible. It would act as a stretch goal. I learned this phrase from Rob. You should set yourself goals that are difficult to achieve. It would open up a field of BQI, that should be biological quantum interface experiments. And it might be interesting in the context of device-independent cryptography. It's very unlikely that quantum theory would be violated. Actually, for me, it's not so much the dualism as the superdeterminism. I find superdeterminism an especially unpleasant feature of any physical theory. And I think that non-locality in quantum theory is trying to tell us something very deep about the physical world. And it would be kind of disappointing if actually the world was local after all. And yet you had this this superdeterminism. On the other hand, it would be really exciting from the point of view of the study of mind and related issues. So it's kind of win-win. If the experiment was, if quantum theory were violated, then this would be a tremendously significant result. It's hard to think of a result in science that would be more significant, but again, it's unlikely. And in that case, if it were violated, we'd need to perform future experiments using more and more complex inanimate systems as well as other types of animate systems. So one question is what are the odds of something like this actually violating quantum theory? And on my most optimistic days, I think it's somewhere between 1 and 2%. But that may be much higher than most people. Thank you.
First question, how much money are you willing to bet on this $1 to $100? That seems like really good odds.
Oh, right, sure. I mean, I'll bet you a dollar. I just don't know.
So I'm worried about an issue. Suppose that the experiment shows that, you know, if you have human-controlled settings, then everything satisfies the Bell inequalities, mm-hmm. and if it's not, they get violated.
Yeah.
So the conclusion that you think one could draw from that is there is a superdeterministic local model of the world. It's just that in the situations where humans aren't deciding the settings, mm-hmm. you know, that the superdeterminism can act to generate the appearance of non-locality. But in those cases where, you know, the humans are choosing the settings, the superdeterminism can't.
It would have to be sufficiently superdeterministic to explain that, which is already too superdeterministic. You might be able to entertain some indeterminism in such a model, but
what I just described the human settings is meant to foil the superdeterministic mechanisms.
Exactly, yeah.
So you're positing a world wherein there's these superdeterministic mechanisms that are, first of all, not part of standard physics, because mm-hmm. We would have to imagine that there's some sort of ghostly causal influence mm-hmm. Locally propagating right. the information on the left wing to the right wing, mm-hmm. which is not part of our standard set of
right.
things that propagate mm-hmm. causal influences. But it's also a highly choreographed causal influence, because, you know, I could choose the settings mm-hmm. based on like the Big Bell test, you know, crazy random information from all over the place, and it mm-hmm. all has to come together.
Yeah.
And the question is, if you're positing that much strange, ghostly, causal influence mm-hmm. in the theory that explains this,
right.
then why not posit a much more modest, strange, ghostly, causal influence mm-hmm. from the human choices to the amount of noise in the detector? So there's a funny, outside regular physics, ghostly influence from the decisions I'm making to how much noise gets imposed on sort of the measurement that the detector's doing, mm-hmm. and if I get enough noise, of course, the Bell inequalities will cease to be violated.
All right.
So I could easily. So this is sort of the opposite of the usual local.
All right.
I'm imagining. Suppose the universe is non-local, yeah. but there's just this set of ghostly influences from human agents to the amount of noise the detectors has. And that makes the world seem local, when in fact it's non-local. Right. And it's only in that situation that it makes it seem local. I mean, it seems like less crazy than the alternative, because it didn't require choreography across great space and lots of organizing principles. It just required this one ghostly influence from...
I mean, I think it's very fine-tuned somehow. Why would it only in that situation make things local, whereas...
Well...
it seems weird. I mean, there's fine-tuning arguments on either side, I suppose. But,
that's my point. That it seems to me it's a more modest kind of fine-tuning than what you need to explain the violations of Bell inequalities
so
in every other experiment.
For you, satisfying the Bell inequalities when you impose locality would actually prove non-locality.
I'm saying it's easier to generate a satisfaction of Bell inequalities in a world that naturally violates the Bell inequalities than it is to generate a violation of Bell inequalities in a world that naturally satisfies the Bell inequalities. Because in order to generate the appearance of an inequality, you have to have choreography across space, and it has to depend on all these things in the causal past of what chose the setting. Whereas to merely simulate the satisfaction, I just have to add a bit of noise.
Yeah. And I'm not convinced. I mean, one question that is why do people spend so much time doing these experiments? I mean, people have done more and more difficult experiments, even before talking about humans. You know, that why, if you had done, imagine if when they used random number generators to do the experiment, they had finally seen Bell's inequalities being satisfied and quantum theory being violated. Was that the conclusion you would have drawn in that case as well? It seems like I mean, it seems that Bell's theorem sets up a certain idea that you have to impose locality, that you try to arrange things so that no information can get from one side to the other, and then you can try different ways of trying to arrange that. I don't know. It's a matter of taste, of course, but I find it less crazy to think that you're successfully imposing the sort of the locality conditions. But yeah, it's a matter of taste. How about my question? If they had seen finally Bell's inequality being satisfied when they used random number generators, is that the conclusion you would have drawn in that case?
So I think if you described it as, suppose it was only with quantum random number generators, let's say.
Right.
Okay. So if I choose the settings deterministically based on, you know, random information I found on the web from all over the place, the Bell inequalities are violated. But if I do it based on quantum random number generators, they're satisfied.
Right.
So now what I need to endorse in my local model is a highly choreographed, super deterministic explanation that's simulating non-locality. And it seems to me more plausible to say, when somehow that quantum random number generator mechanism influenced the amount of noise in my local detectors, that's a much more plausible ghostly influence that I could more easily incorporate into an updated theory than the crazy choreographed one that I need to make sense of the local explanation.
I mean, it's true. I do think superdeterminism is the least pleasant feature of structure, and you're saying, and that's what you're doing is taking it in a particular direction. Somehow not convinced. I have to think about it.
So you drew a conclusion supposing that you did this human experiment and the Bell inequalities were restored. What would you conclude if you had humans in the experiment and that zero-sin inequalities were violated?
And they could maybe make problems onto something. Sure. I mean, that's the kind of result you might expect to see.
I don't see the connection.
Suddenly having humans in the picture unleashes the non-locality even more so than it was already.
More
plausible to me somehow.
But if you don't have random settings, wouldn't you have a model that would simulate perhaps post-quantum correlations?
Simulate post...
I'm wondering if having not random settings would introduce a kind of loophole that would allow you to, simulate correlations beyond quantum without actually that being the true nature of your physical system. In the way that, the detection loophole could allow you to... using just classical systems, violate quantities. So I mean, if you saw that in the experiment, the first thing that I would try to understand is whether humans may not be as random as to guarantee a loophole free experiment. That would be my first.
Okay.
The first thing I would try to understand.
Okay, sure. I mean, here I wasn't proposing closing the other loopholes at the same time, just because that would be too difficult.
Yeah.
I would be satisfied with seeing a violation of quantum theory just under this, under the controls I mentioned. I think that would be already a discussion.
So in a world with interventions, mm-hmm. presumably not just the detector settings, but actually all the physical fields would depend on the interventions. Like a world where I decide to build a house has a different electric field structure than one where I choose to
build. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah. But it's unusual to impose the locality conditions that you see this kind of violations.
Sure.
You have a reason to suppose.
But I wonder what would happen to like more mundane physics if you
yeah.
attempted to modify it to allow for such interventions of this sort. Like,
I think there's worries that you would violate energy conservation, kinds of conservation principles.
Mm-hmm.
I think that those kinds of issues are being discussed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's unusual, I think, to have a situation where you can see very clearly what would happen in a particular model of this sort.
I see.
It's sort of difficult to imagine, opening up the human brain and sort of analyzing the sort of behavior of individual atoms and seeing if they violated quantum theory. That's not an experiment that you'd easily get funding for. And also, it's not clear what you would look for anyway. Whereas this kind of experiment, at least there's a clear idea that would lead to a violation of quantum theory.
Maybe a more sociological question. I'm basically curious, because there are also crazy people out there who make suggestions about consciousness and quantum mechanics that
are
far beyond what makes sense.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to make sure that this kind of distance between these two
right,
is still kept to these other people. So it seems a bit difficult to have the kind of way to explain the things and to motivate it and to make publicity in a way that clarifies why this is a reasonable thing.
That's true, for many years I left these papers I wrote in a cardboard box in the basement and forgot about them for those kinds of reasons. It's hard to say if in the case where an experiment like this did violate quantum theory, of course, it would be significant, and we'd have to find a way to understand that.
Were the reactions to your paper already from the side, or is it?
From which paper?
The one you mentioned, that Michael Savides
also. The only reaction I had, no, I didn't have any reactions from people. I gave it a boring title, so Mike seemed to have been the only person who noticed it outside of physics. Yeah, no, it's a concern, and it's difficult to know how to investigate these kinds of models without that kind of concern. But this idea has been suggested, not just by me, but by John Bell mentioned it in several of the papers where people have done these experiments. They've talked about using humans to try and impose the workouts of conditions, pre-settings conditions. So the idea is out there, and in some ways, it's the natural next challenge for. That experiment.
Just around your thought. So here, if I understand, what you want is you want to use basically this information from the brain waves to somehow determine the settings of the experiment.
Mm.
But have you thought perhaps having an intermediate step where you would take that information and then perform some kind of random amplification or expansion and then use only that as to decide
right.
the measurement.
Yeah, I thought about doing some of that. I mean, one has to, any unnecessary delays would cause problems. You'd have to do it very quickly. But it might be that the best thing to do is to amplify it as quickly as possible.
Because I know that this protocol that sometimes are used, that it's not that they generate random numbers. They need like a seed of randomness, and then they do something with it.
Yeah.
I was wondering if perhaps, you're stealing some, perhaps a shorter string of
more random bits
yeah.
from this initial seed for vibrant humans would perhaps...
That might be better way to do it. I mean, I don't think you're expecting those signals. It's sort of, it's in the onset period that you really would want to catch it. And you know, so you'd want to be looking at the derivative of this rather than, or maybe some hashing on the signal.
It's a little related to the last question. I think, I mean, in order for this to work, it's necessary that these human decisions or implicit decisions that be in some sense free.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly what that means by introspection. I've never felt free in that sense, so I don't know.
Yes,
but I'm wondering if one could do some kind of simpler test rather than the full-blown experiment. So, I mean, if decisions were free, should they mimic a random process, or can they be highly correlated, for example? I mean, is there some sort of, if you see what I mean, some sort of way we could just ask a person to make several decisions? We don't need that extreme speed. And then see whether or not they conform to the idea of free decision. Suppose you ask someone to make free choose a bit every 10 seconds or every minute or something, and you found that they were highly compressible in the end, or it could be predicted by
stuff. It's more about the intervention aspect of it.
What I was about to say is that actually happened in this Big Bell test.
Yeah.
So basically in that test, what they asked is like many people like around the world to do that, just to sit and start pressing zeros at once.
Yeah.
And you would get feedback like every 10 seconds or so saying, hey, your bits are actually not that random, or it would give you like the rate of compression.
Do better.
Random,
not just kind of clump in a way that people don't expect.
While these whole random numbers were set up by all these people, they were like, you know, updating you saying, well, this could have been predicted by this artificial intelligence
if it could be predicted by artificial intelligence, then even though it might be quote unquote free,
there's a classic example of a person who goes into a restaurant, same restaurant all the time, and they look at the menu and they choose the same thing every time. Now it's a free choice and it's entirely predictable by you and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's distinct from randomness, which is the distinction you're trying to make.
Mm-hmm.
But is it going to be I take it that this is the question. This
That's
is just an example to illustrate it. Is it satisfactory for the experiment? Those kind of choices?
I mean, the point is to investigate these things. I mean, if you violate one, you're sure it's satisfactory, but you need to set up some templates to filter on different signals first and see what happens. I mean, you can't do anything more than investigate, different signals, different filters and see what happens. So, I mean, you can do things like hashing and try to make the thing more random, but there is the distinction. I mean, here I had a sort of intervention model in mind, that these things are somehow interventions that are somehow not anticipated, so you can't communicate the information to the other side. And that's slightly different from a free variable. I mean, a free variable would maybe have to be, if it was truly free, would have to be random, would have to be an intervention, but in this Bell sense, but not vice versa. You know, it could have interventions without them being, but still be predictable.
If they're predictable, some machine could be actually predicting them and sending the information to the other wing of the experiment.
Right. But,
I mean, there could be something in nature that we don't know about.
Right.
That functions that way.
Yeah, I mean, sure, you could... I mean, the other end of the experiment is going to make a guess as to what the sort of, in this sort of super deterministic model, the other end of the experiment is making a guess as to what the setting is going to be. And you want to wrong step it, or wrong foot it, what is the expression? Wrong foot. So one can just try it.
So the two motivations for the experiment were, one, to provide an impetus for like advancing mind-machine interfaces, basically, and two, to test, if I understand correctly, whether both, like, conscious beings are free in the strongest possible sense of the word, and also that quantum mechanics depends on that consciousness. That's kind of there.
Yeah, I mean, so the motivation for imagining that humans might be unusual in some sense is consciousness, but this wouldn't directly test that issue. It would just test what it tests.
So it seems to me that all of the first motivation and much of the second would be preserved if you used like mice or something instead of people.
Sure,
that would
sure,
be a lot cheaper,
sure.
And you could put a machine on them for
like
decades, probably.
Decades,
I mean,
yeah,
as long as a mouse lives.
Yeah. I mean, you have to fill different forms in to do that. On mice versus people.
But sure,
you use mice, yeah.
That was awesome.
Whatever, yeah.
So I'm thinking again about these super deterministic models that would be shown to be true in your favorite interpretation of the what you know positive outcome would imply. So it seems to me in those super deterministic models, I would have also have expected to have an illusion of superluminal signaling when messages were chosen not by human agents but by random processes. So what do I mean by that? So I've got this random process here that's generating bits, zeros, and one at random. And you know, normally we'd expect that you know the outcome of distance measurements, that probability distribution shouldn't depend on the zeros and ones here.
Yeah.
But there's a super deterministic model that plays, and the process that determines these outcomes are actually determined by things in the past, which are causally influencing things over there. So it would be natural if actually those distributions did vary, and it's not a superluminal cause, it's just a super deterministic explanation of the appearance of signaling.
Yeah.
But then as soon as I make the messages depend on the will of a human agent, that illusion of signaling disappears.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be sort of a challenge then to explain why is that we don't see this transition from illusions of signaling to you know no illusion of signaling as I switch from random sources to human agents.
Right.
But I do see a transition from Bell inequality violation to Bell inequality satisfaction when I make that change.
Right.
I mean that. So in a sense, you get back to the central what I consider the central mystery of Bell's theorem, which is you know why causal influence but no signaling.
Right.
This superdeterministic explanation would have that same kind of tension in it, and it would cry out for some explanation.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I mean,
we know on the basis of the data we have that any local model would have to have some sort of superdeterminism in it. I suppose people have done these experiments, closed little loopholes. I think I agree. I mean, well, I'm proposing an experiment because once you have it, you know, in the unlikely case that an experiment has to have two things: it has to be motivated, and maybe you're pushing on the motivation of the experiment. But in the case where it turned out to violate quantum theory, then we'd have something to work with, and we could try different interpretations and so on. Further experiments would be done if we come to an understanding finally. But we already have, like you said, we already have this problem. We already have the problem of why is Bell's inequality violated, and yet we don't see signaling. We have that problem. So.
And I guess I've just pointed to a weakness of the super deterministic account, which
essentially
doesn't really settle the tension because it introduces a new tension, you know, why don't we see the illusion of signal?
There could be some natural mechanism, just like in De Broglie-Bohm, which is sort of similar. You get this natural relaxation to equilibrium where signaling is washed out very quickly. You can even turn De Broglie-Bohm into a local superdeterministic model.
Just by positing that the information about all the positions of all the particles is located at each point in space-time, plus the information about the wave function, okay, so that's now a local model, a local superdeterministic model. And initially it would lead to apparent signaling, but it would very quickly be washed out by relaxation to equilibrium. So there's one example where that would happen. Ellie?
I think there's two different questions which you could ask
regarding the motivation of the experiment. So one is along the lines that Rob is asking, which is, it's hard to accept the hypothesis of superdeterminism for a whole bunch of reasons.
Yeah.
And on that note, if you were going to have a locality in superdeterminism, mm-hmm. aside from needing to explain the lack of signaling, I think the more subtler point is what Belen was raising, which is that you'd have to explain why you are specifically stopping at the violation, which is up to Joseph's inequalities and not beyond. So even if you could find some mm-hmm. explanation, which would say, okay, you don't signal with superdeterminism, even though I could, now you have to go further and say, in the subtle, you know, zero volume slice of the non-signaling ones, even then, there's these other rules which quantum mechanics happens to perfectly predict, but now we need a completely other different information for it. So that's challenging, but suppose that that's open. The other question, though, is if you endorse superdeterminism and locality as a real possibility, then what you're saying is all violations to date of bounded qualities are artifacts of the interventions not being
right.
free.
Yeah.
And so now you say, if I could just find a free intervention, mm-hmm. then I would be able to expose this fact.
Right.
So I guess the question becomes, how do you motivate free will specifically, this is sort of a personal question, as the likeliest candidate for a free intervention? Right? It could be that there are free interventions that are possible, mm-hmm. but they have nothing to do with human consciousness.
Right.
It has to do with atomic decay. That's free will, but nothing else. Not sort of like photons passing through beams. So are you sort of saying that it's reasonable to assume that an intervention, if there's going to be one, which is, you know, free from the superdeterminism, mm-hmm. it would be free will. Is that motivated by the measurement problem? Is that motivated by sort of the free will Conway Persian?
I mean, I think so. The intervention model for sort of my mass duality was possibly long before quantum theory was invented. So it's been there for a long time as a sort of model to sort of account for consciousness in some way. So that already exists. I mean, of course, it's not. I think very few scientists would nowadays back that. But it's a model. It's something we have a chance to do a test on. So that's the motivation. But I think other models. I mean, people have already investigated. You know, not atom decay, but a photon hitting a beam splitter. Mm-hmm. People investigated that and didn't find a violation of Bernoulli qualities. More recently, people have tested taking signals from further afield, so from stellar systems in the galaxy, and intend to do even further experiments, taking signals from even further away. So people are doing these experiments, and this is another kind of experiment you could imagine doing.
So you're sort of interpreting this as saying, for those people who use superdeterminism and locality to explain mm-hmm. Bell violations, for that crowd, mm-hmm. I will now prove, under that assumption, mm-hmm. that consciousness is not a free intervention. That would be the interpretation of maintaining.
It's not right, maintaining a violation of Bell, but under that. That's right, yes. That would be one way of saying it.
No,
it would only prove that if Bell's inequalities depended on that assertion, right? Like I think if you assume locality and you continue to see a violation of Bell's inequalities, even when you use humans to do the setting, then it seems that humans have to get swept up into this superdeterminism. So I think that's what you're saying. And I would agree with that. I'm not sure who believes, which group of people believe in locality, and the explanation for violation of Bell's inequalities is superdeterminism. And there's a few people like Toft. But experimentalists continue to do more and more refined experiments. And so somehow implicitly, they are assuming it's worth doing those experiments. And the only foundational reason for that would be this belief, you know, that you believe. I mean, there are probably other reasons for it, like technological reasons, but the only foundational reason, I think, is if you think it's worth doing an experiment because it might go wrong, then superdeterminism is what you're pursuing.
stop here. Let's thank Lucy again.
Thank you.